Psychology at Work. A podcast series exploring the work of professionals in the mental health care field, developed by the Psychology Department at Western Connecticut State University. Hello, this is your host, Dr. Shane Murphy, and today we're interviewing Dr. Mary Murphy, who is a health psychologist here at Neurological Associates in Danbury, Connecticut.
So, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. And this is an interview series, really. We're interviewing 9 or 10 people in the mental health profession field. And it's all about what you do. So, let me start off by asking, what do you do?
I'm a clinical psychologist, so we're right on theme. And actually, there's subspecialties within clinical psych, and mine is health psychology. So if anybody's thinking about graduate school and stuff, it's certain programs will have subspecialties. And I chose health within clinical psych because I always liked medicine and I liked psychology, and I couldn't figure out, I wasn't so great with the science part, and it was very difficult, you know, thinking about trying to go pre-med, but I loved working in medical settings. I loved working with medical patients, and so I ended up finding there was only 5 programs at the time that had health psych. Now it's much more open, but local in New York, I ended up going to Yeshiva University, and it's a great program because they allowed health psych to really be side by side with the medical students. The first year we were in the same auditoriums with the same lectures. It was great. It was a very nice blended curriculum. So people who are interested in medicine and psychology, health psych is one of those options. If you want to work, for example, the settings I've kind of worked in are places like hospitals, detox centers. Right now I work embedded within a medical neurology office. So there's a group of 9 neurologists, and they're on the top floor, and we're right below in behavioral medicine, and we have, you're having 3 of them with your group series, right?
Right, Diana Nadeo.
And John Woodhouse. Yeah. We have 3 psychologists and 4 neuropsychologists, so 7 altogether. And neuropsychology, while I'm on the topic, is another subspecialty in psychology. And so we work hand in hand. They do kind of memory testing, cognitive abilities, IQ exams, dementia testing and screenings. And then on my side, what I do is I'm doing therapy and testing. So I end up primarily getting referrals from upstairs, the neurologists, where people are having kind of adjustment issues. You know, like, could you imagine if you get a diagnosis like MS or even Alzheimer's, lots of different types of dementia, if you are, you know, get these diagnoses, there's a lot that happens. You know, things about your identity changes, your work changes possibly, your family life, so many things change. And they have a lot of adjustment stress, you know, dealing with how to incorporate this new knowledge into their life, and they end up needing extra support. And that was the original intention of our department, was to support people with chronic and acute health conditions, be able to adjust to their medical symptoms and everything that comes with it, how it affects every part of your life. So I end up working with most of the referrals from them. So medical populations, we see people after they've had a stroke, but we see people as young as, I think our youngest is 3. So we have the whole gamut because we have a child psychologist too. So there's a pediatric neurologist upstairs. So we see people who come in for attention deficit disorder, Tourette's, other childhood neurological conditions, and they and their families, of course, have a lot to adjust to, so they come downstairs too. And we do counseling with them for however long they need. It's usually kind of brief. It's usually kind of a medical crisis, and how do you incorporate, you know, this, all of the symptoms into your getting back into your life as much as possible, you know, with limitations that they may have now. And then the other part of my job is we also take referrals from the community. So we have even people who, you know, found us on the website for our insurance, and it says that we specialize in substance abuse. That's one of my specialties. So they'll see that and they'll send the patients to me through the insurance. And then we do testing also. So like in previous classes, you probably learned about stuff like personality tests, MMPI. Do they take classes that expose them to that?
Nick?
Right?
Assessment.
Assessment?
Yeah.
You take assessment? Okay. So you get exposed to classes where, you know, they teach you about like kind of the, you know, there's the top core tests that are kind of given in this field. So we do IQ tests. We do personality tests like the MMPI. Another one we tend to like better than the MMPI, the PAI, the Personality Assessment Inventory. And the point of doing it is that we're able to, we're big on kind of quantifying and measuring people's symptoms before they come and, you know, start real treatment with us. We want to see how much there's depression, how much is there anxiety, so that we could kind of see in our field. We don't have blood tests, right? We want to see, though, are there improvements over time? And if you go into this field, you will see that by the time you get into the field, it'll be even more so. It's really, our field has moved more towards not just subjective, how do you feel, but measuring how do you feel. And so trying to find ways to, we call quantify and measure symptoms is really a key part of what we do. And it helps keep us on target, because it's funny, just had this happen today, but it's funny how you won't know, someone will come for therapy and they'll say they're depressed. Okay, but like the thing that probably was fueling their depression, we may not get around to. But if there's a large inventory of questions that we ask up front and it touches on past trauma and past substance use, their personality variables, things like that, we then know, okay, there's other things that are probably fueling what I see today. So that becomes a very big key to understanding what's going on with someone.
Now, it's interesting because the previous two times I've taught this applied seminar, it's been on health psychology.
Oh.
And so we spend multiple weeks on the topic of stress, which you just brought up. Obviously, it's a very big part of health psychology, psychoneuroimmunology, and then stress management, and then coping mechanisms, and so on. So maybe just tell us a little bit, how do you help a person deal with stress? What sort of therapeutic approaches do you use? Okay.
So we all kind of have different approaches that are different brands of psychology, I'd say. You know, so mine, I use a couple of different ones. One is a mind-body kind of approach, which uses, has anybody ever heard of biofeedback?
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Well, our very first interviewer talked about it quite a lot, interviewee.
So I don't have to explain it, but that's what I do. So that's something, they may not have what we have, though. There's the five different types of biofeedback, and what we do is muscle-based, because people have tension in their body, and then they get all tensed up, and so we're teaching them muscle retraining. This is how it kind of intersects with medicine and health a lot. It's not just how do you feel, and let's talk about that. So this mind-body approach is teaching people that when they're stressed or they're upset, they're actually holding their body even differently. And that creates tension and even worsening of physical conditions over time. And, you know, probably everybody knows that when you're tense, you tend to tense up. Imagine being like that because of being in chronic pain or something for your whole life. So learning to undo that is one of the reasons we use this approach. So we have a lot of chronic pain patients too. So I use biofeedback. And then I also use cognitive behavioral approaches. So that is basically a blend of how does your thinking influence your behavior. And so I usually talk to people about the kind of thinking errors that we all make, all of us. There's certain things that we all do to some degree. And for example, some people have a tendency to kind of see things in black and white. You know, like they don't see it in between, little shades of gray. Like, I need to be diet and exercise, full blown, I'm doing everything, or oh, I'm off the track, I can't do this anymore. You know, it's an on-off switch sometimes. We all tend to do stuff like that. And so in the beginning, we give like an inventory to see what kind of style people tend to have. If they have a style where they see things in black and white, we talk about that. How do you start to kind of see that there's an in-between? That if you have an off day, it's not the end of the world. And so basically everybody has a certain number of, there's actually 50 of them, but top 10, I'd say, that people tend to do. And it contributes to making people get stuck. They get stuck in relationships, they get stuck in work they don't like, they get stuck in all aspects of their life. They get stuck doing the same thing, or parenting even the same way, yet it doesn't work. You know, like the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over, but expecting different results. We'll do that to some degree. We're using the same approach and we're like, why isn't this working? Then we do it the next day. Why isn't this working? And it's frustrating, but we don't know how to get out of it. So we tend to point out and explain to people, okay, these are the kinds of things that we all do, but there's ways to kind of be aware of it. And when you're more self-aware, you tend to do less. And then the other thing, because this is health related issues I'm usually dealing with, I talk a lot about, I don't actually explain what I'm doing, but I'm using motivational counseling. So there's not a lot that we really want to do, you know? You get up in the morning and you are told you have to do this and you got to go do that and you got to do your work and you got to go to school. And with health, it's one more thing. People are like, okay, I don't want to diet. I don't want to exercise. I don't want to check my blood sugar 10 times today like I was told to. You know, whatever the intervention is, because they have a medical condition, it's hard for people to do it. It's like every day I have this list. I always have to do these things and I don't want to do them. So I work with people to try to encourage them to do the things that their health plans, you know, basically their doctors have, you know, instructed them to do. So we have people that have sleep issues, but they don't want to use their sleep apnea machines. So we help them. Do you know what that is? It's like this little hose. And okay. So it's like a mask. It's not attractive, right? It's not fun. It's not like, oh, yeah, I want to go put this on and go to sleep, you know? No. So, and some people even are claustrophobic, and you have to kind of work through, like, desensitizing them to it. So whatever these medical recommendations are, they're not always pleasant. And you have to, you know, find ways to be creative and encouraging. And motivational counseling is another kind of subset of or brand of psychology that takes people where they're at and helps them get to the next step by using their own internal motivation. And so they might not want to be putting that mask on at night, but they want to have a good number at their next doctor's visit. You know, you kind of work with and harness what motivation there is and you help them take the next step. And so in some ways, that turns out to be a little bit like behavior modification, too.
Great. This is a question I've asked everybody, is sort of what got you interested in the field? Can you remember, well, where did you go to college? And can you remember as a freshman, was this a career you were considering even then?
Actually, no. So I went to Manhattanville College in Purchase, New York, in Westchester. And I I ended up, it's like across the street from my high school. I like walked over the street. No, I wanted to be a writer. I've always wanted to write, and everything that I do, I have always picked occupations where I'm writing a lot because I love writing. And so by the end of, I think my sophomore year, I got a job at a halfway house with women who were, they didn't have symptoms like severe enough to be in the hospital, but they ended up not being like stable enough to live on their own. So that's why they call it halfway, you know. They call them community residences now. But so I was fascinated by it. It was like Girl Interrupted. I mean, it was like there were women who were cutting. There were some of the first cases of HIV I'd ever seen, because this was 94, when still people were kind of like very afraid about HIV, like not, you know, out of ignorance, not knowing. And there was, basically, I realized that in psychology, there's so many different things that I could do. There were so many different settings. And then when I saw that psychology was in the hospital, my sister worked at a hospital and she got me my first job. And I was like, okay, I can have the best of both worlds. I really love this. And I thought I wanted to go to graduate school, but I wasn't sure yet. So in college, I just worked in, I worked at Four Winds Hospital as a mental health worker. And I worked in a hospital, like a medical hospital, on a detox floor in Westchester also. I feel old, it's closed now. In Port Chester, it closed down.
Port Chester?
Yeah, United Hospital, it's closed.
That's right. Mother and father-in-law live.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, they lost their hospital. So when I saw that, you know, my interests were kind of coming together, that I liked psychology and medicine, that's how it kind of all came together.
Let me ask you, because we have talked about different approaches to therapy, mm-hmm. cognitive behavioral, psychodynamic, mm-hmm. Motivational interviewing, and so on. Did you choose to become a cognitive behavioral therapist? Do you think it was because of your personality that just fit, or was it you more your instructors and the school you went to? How does that happen?
Yeah, I don't think I knew ahead of time at all what my program was known for, except for health psych. So
At Yeshiva,
yeah. So it was, you know, like it was the main thing that was being taught at the time. Because I went to school from 2001 to 2007. It's not supposed to take that long. It's supposed to take 5 years, not six. Don't take a long time doing your dissertation if you go to graduate school. So then mentors, because actually after I left my program, that was more influential on what I decided to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was really lucky. I just kind of fell into people that are really kind of high up in substance abuse, and people who were connected enough that I was actually able to be trained by the people who created motivational interviewing. I was like able to go to New Mexico and have Bill Miller teach me it.
Wow.
And I was like, I'm not that old. He's just still around. He's, you know, it was great mm-hmm. that, you know, like, you know, these are like the founding fathers. And so I was...
It'd be like going and learning DBT from Marshall and
Ahead. Yeah, I know. And I had a mentor who was taught by her, and it was a little crazy. She said she would call her in the middle of the night because they had cell phones during their training, that they had to be prepared to be on call for their patients all the time. And Marsha would call with like random things in the middle of the night just to spice things up, I guess.
Well, she developed
yeah, well,
that
she
therapy
created it.
For self-care, basically.
I know, now she that she's come out.
She's come out, and she was psychiatrically hospitalized for many years.
Yeah. And it's funny because the people that have created these things, it's so much a person-based thing. You know, the person, Bill Miller, who created motivational interviewing, that was truly his style that he then manualized. This was just like him. And Marsha Linehan, it was what she knew worked, you know, and from a personal perspective, she knew it worked. This wasn't like ivory tower, somebody in a research lab that was totally disconnected and didn't understand what would really help people. And that's what I think is really great about mentors that I've had and the founding fathers of the things that I follow. I think they all have that in common.
So how do you create a good working relationship with the mentor? I mean, there's somebody, you're looking at them, you're like, this is a good person, I'd really like to learn from them. What happens?
So I have a funny story about this. You know Santucci?
Tony, yeah.
Yeah, he was my first mentor.
Mentor, okay. He teaches here.
God, it sound terrible. I mean that. So he was my professor, my psychology professor in college at Manhattanville. And he, to this day, we still stay in touch. I mean, it's really amazing. He's a great guy. And how that happens is, for example, I wanted to do more than what was in the classroom. So I went to him and I said, could I do something? I wanted to do my thesis. You could do that like if you wanted to approach somebody for independent study or you're doing your thesis. When you do something outside the classroom, that is definitely where you get to know a professor, and you also then figure out, is this person a good personality match for me? And do they have things that kind of make sense? Like, you know, if they're into, you know, one area of psychology that you have no interest or knowledge of, it's not a good fit. So it's a way that you start to forge a connection and you know that it's helpful. And I think that's all that we did, was we just started to work outside of regular class time and just approach when you had an idea about something.
And similar things happened at Yeshiva with some of the people there?
I think graduate programs are different than mine, but we were encouraged to have people outside. Mm-hmm. So mine, I had already had a workplace at Montefiore Medical Center, and so the people that I was doing like practicum and an internship with, later those were my work people that ended up being mentors to me. And so approaching somebody because you're doing a project, that's how it evolves. It's God, it's a lot easier now with email. I just thought about how like how I did it back then might be a little different, but just staying in touch with somebody.
Just bugging them.
Yeah, like literally, I think that's what I would say to anybody even now. Like if you're interested in doing something, the person would email you and say, you know, can I shadow you at work? Can I do this? Can I do that?
Can I do a project with you?
Definitely the project.
Data or interview people. Or...
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. And he got me my first job interview coming out of college.
Tony did?
Yeah.
Well, he teaches for us. He's teaching cognitive psychology.
Yeah.
251 this semester.
Yeah.
So these, many of them are graduating in this class. Many
okay.
of the students. What's your advice to a young graduate? Sort of this not saying. Starting out in the field.
So if you, it's two different things. It's, do you want to go to graduate school or not? It's the big decision. The biggest thing that I was told, and I think is kind of like a gold standard, is that if you want to go to graduate school, you need to work in the field. So graduate school is a little bit of a business when you think about it. They want to know that you're going to graduate, that you're committed, that you can do this. So if you have some experience in the field, and that could be, you know, working at a local, you know, clinic, you know, anywhere you can get experience to demonstrate that you get what the field is about and that you want to actually pursue it and spend all of this time for the next 5 years of your life at least immersed in it. They want to know that you're going to graduate and stick with it. So if you have a couple of years of experience under your belt in some fashion, you're in the best position to get into graduate school. So even if you don't intend to ever do any research, if it's a PhD program, they want to see that. If it's a PsyD program, do we know the difference?
We've talked about okay. that. Looking at the Golden
Model. Yes, yes. So if you're a purely clinical, expect to only be in the clinical counseling area, and you're going to a PsyD program, that doesn't apply. So what I said is just for pursuing PhD. And... so basically getting experience, you know, like in community psych and the placements that people have when they're here, that's the start. And then that becomes, you know, the next step and connections, because having a network is just meeting one person who leads you to the next person. And let the first person even be your professor that leads you to the first person, and then you network yourself. But when you kind of just haven't had any experience, it's a really hard sell to make an application for graduate school.
Great. And Dr. Murphy is teaching our community psychology advanced seminar this semester for the first time.
Yes.
And I thank you so much for taking that over. I'm hearing great things about it. Yeah. She's agreed to do it again in the fall.
And two students were offered full-time jobs.
Out of their placements.
Out of the placements. Yeah.
And same with Psych 306, which is our internship.
Yeah.
Two students have been offered full-time jobs there.
So, great. So, yeah.
Certainly one way to get your foot in the door, right?
Definitely. Yeah.
So at this point, I hand it over to the class and let them ask questions.
I'm going to ask.
So Barbara is our honorary first question asker.
Okay.
Well, it's funny you talk about the sleep apnea because I refuse to wear one. Oh. I'm very claustrophobic. But you were speaking about internships and everything. Mm-hmm. I am going to grad school, my master's.
Okay.
The day after I graduate here,
oh,
I
wow.
start.
Wow.
I want to get some kind of a job or if something wrong in graduate school to get mm-hmm. the experience that you talk about.
Yeah.
Where do I find this? Do I talk to the professors like you said, or
which program is it?
The licensed mental health counselor.
Okay. Because some programs are very well defined and structured and they place you. I would venture to guess they're not going to place you, but doesn't mean they don't have connections. When you're in school, some of the things that you qualify to do already is being like a psych technician, mental health counselor. What are the other job titles, basically? I actually learned during the first part, the master's part, a lot about psychology, not in person, but I was, you know, paying the bills and I had to work. And at the time I worked at an insurance company for disability claims and I had all the psych claims. And so I was talking to people on the phone about their disability. I was interviewing, I was basically reviewing all the documentation that comes from all their specialists and learning about people that way. That was a way to kind of like pay the bills. But it still remained in psychology. But I would say face-to-face direct clinical contact is the, you know, the best thing for you to try to do. And that's, where do you live?
Waterbury.
So is there like a psych hospital nearby or anything?
I'm from New York.
Oh, because where's Watertown?
Southampton.
It's near Waterbury, right?
Right next to you can try to go to St. Mary's or Waterbury Hospital. Or the clinics within
Marbury. Yeah, they have.
Or if you're coming here for classes, Danbury Hospital.
Right.
Have you worked in Danbury Hospital?
I did my clinical with nursing.
In nursing, yeah.
Okay. It's hard to get that first step in the door in the hospital.
Right.
Yes, I know. Very hard to get into Danbury Hospital. Yes. Do you have any like area within psych that you like? Because I was thinking like MCCA and places like that for
PTSD.
Substance use. Are you near a VA?
It's down in West Virginia. I'm a veteran, so.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, that would be actually be helpful. Very helpful.
You could leverage that, perhaps.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because they make you even indicate that on your applications. I've applied for VA jobs.
But they don't hire you without at least a master's or the VA. The only jobs you can get is a research technician, which I applied to.
That wouldn't be bad at all, because research tech, you're getting a lot of mental health experience.
Because after my master's, I want to get a job in that while I go proceed to the doctorate.
Yeah. Mostly, I would say hospitals and clinics. So if Waterbury is closer to you, Waterbury has, at Waterbury Hospital, they have a whole like level of care spectrum. They have intensive outpatient, they have regular outpatient. Intensive outpatient is where they go to therapy and treatment 5 days a week. So they're there for several hours every day. And I call it therapy boot camp. So they have like a program that you could actually, you know, fit into. And you don't have to have more than a bachelor's to work in that capacity.
Because I did my clinical on the psych ward at Danbury mm-hmm. Hospital. I just don't know how to put that on a resume yet. So once I figure that out, then I can.
Oh, yeah, definitely capture that.
Yeah, you can capture that.
Yes, definitely. That counts.
Other questions?
We want to go first.
Go for it.
Okay, before you mentioned that, like, in order to assess improvement of patients, you have to, like, measure how they feel.
Yeah.
Just wondering, are there like certain techniques and tools you use to do that, or is it like different for every case?
It is like a standard. First of all, there's 1,000 things you can use to assess people, and there's a whole science to picking the right one. But in our particular setting, we use some gold standards. Like you've probably learned a little bit about Aaron Beck. He's another one of the founding fathers, And so Beck has a depression and anxiety kind of questionnaires that we score. And it gives us this very quick clinical snapshot of how depressed and how anxious somebody is. And then, and then we do the personality assessment inventory, and that tells personality things. Like, for example, if somebody tends to experience their emotions in a physical way, there's somatization is a common problem in my field, because they tend to kind of feel their feelings often in a physical way. So the combination of pain and emotional pain gets mixed up a lot. So that's like a general way to explain that. But so those factors are important to know. And it also picks up psychotic symptoms, which surprisingly happens a lot.
Now, are they computer scored?
Some are.
Yeah. Like the BDI or?
No, those are hand scored.
You hand score them at the clinic.
Yep, but the PAI is lengthy, and that has scales and graphs and everything the computer generates. But with certain conditions, people will have hallucinations. So, and even medical conditions will sometimes be the reason why they have hallucinations. So we have things like that to kind of tease out whether it's something medical happening. I think I spend most of my day trying to figure out if something is medical or psychological, you know, and it's sort of like, somebody mentioned house, right?
House, yeah.
I like to think I'm house. I try to figure that out.
Or it's both.
Yes.
Jake?
Exactly.
Yeah. You said you deal with substance abuse.
Yes. Yeah.
So when you're dealing with these patients, what therapy and intervention do you think works best to either correct their problem or even realize what they're doing?
I was taught that motivational counseling is the gold standard. And it doesn't mean that you don't use little bits of everything else along the way, but motivational counseling is just the way to be non-threatening and non-judgmental and really help move somebody from one stage of change to the next. And with substance use, there's a lot of people aren't getting help in the very beginning. It's kind of like waiting until they have enough motivation to show up and consistently show up. And I don't believe that. I believe that you need the help more so in the beginning. And so I think the most important thing is that initial connection and making sure that they understand that they're not being judged at all and that we don't expect it all to be perfect. And the one thing I always do is I acknowledge that they're using for a reason. Like, people don't wake up one day and say, I want to be addicted to drugs. They are using it for some purpose. And so I say, let's find out together. You know, like, it's not on them. You know, you're doing something wrong. But just let's find out together what really was happening that prompted everything. You know, so was it medicating anxiety? Was it, you know, getting addicted to pain pills because they had a surgery? You know, was there some emotional thing happening before? Figuring all that out is the main goal, and that's usually pretty disarming, and people come back.
One of the interesting things I found through research was a higher outcome with patients going through motivational interviewing with either family or friends supporting them. Do you see that often with family being involved with their therapy or friends?
I often find that most people don't have supportive family.
Particularly in relation to substance abuse?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, only,
they feel
yes.
Like they've been burned too many times.
Yeah, there's been a lot of lost relationships by the time somebody goes to treatment often. That's not for everybody, but just specific more to substance abuse. So, but yeah, if family can be involved, then absolutely I try to, because it's usually well-intentioned trying to help ends up being hurtful or enabling, and so... or punitive, like it's all over the map. Like, they try to be helpful and they go in the wrong direction, one way or the other. And so teaching them, if they're willing to be there, that's absolutely what we do. Yeah.
Is there a question I've missed?
All right, let's thank Dr. Murphy for coming in today.